Hi, this is Stuart Harris. Let me ask you a question. What was your least favorite subject in high school? Math? Science, perhaps? Or was it perhaps American history? Shockingly, to my mind at least, for many students, it's their least favorite subject. And it's pretty well established why that is. Most history books are turgid, poorly written, completely whitewashed. Everything that's even potentially offensive is taken out, and the students find it dreadfully dull. Well, you won't find today's discussion of American history dull. It's absolutely fascinating. This is history the way it was meant to be written. We're speaking with Simon Winchester and his fascinating new book, The Men Who United the States. So stick around and learn about a little bit of the context in which the American Constitution developed.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Today we're talking to author Simon Winchester and his wonderful new book, The Men Who United the States. Now, if you were listening last week, you heard the first part of our conversation, but never fear, if you didn't catch that episode, you can catch our podcast. Just Google us online, Your Weekly Constitutional, and you can download that podcast and listen at your leisure. You could even listen to that first and then listen to this once it goes up as a podcast, or you can just listen now, because I'll fill you in on what we've discussed thus far. What we've discussed thus far is how Simon came to write this book, and it turns out that it's a story in and of itself. Simon was a 17-year-old British student who came over to the United States and spent several months here and just fell in love with the country, so much so that he spent much of his subsequent career here covering political events and even things like Evel Knievel's attempt to jump the Snake River Canyon. And along the way, he decided he was going to become an American citizen himself. Most recently, he took another great trip and traveled all around the nation and decided he was going to focus upon a group of men, not really a group of men, but a series of men, a bunch of different men throughout American history who have physically united the states by doing things like building canals, building roads, building railroads, that sort of thing. It's an absolutely fascinating story. It's full of interesting anecdotes. It's full of larger themes. And it really and truly illustrates the context in which much of our Constitution history unfolded. Now, in part one, we had just gotten through discussing how Simon had come to write the book and how he arranged the book. It turns out he picked several different elements according to the ancient Chinese tradition, things like fire and wood and metal, to organize his stories around. And he was just about to tell me, when we ran out of time, he was just about to tell me about a particularly poignant event just before he published his book.
My wife is Japanese, a lady called Setsuko, and her mother and father came over here in the 1950s. And they, Mr. and Mrs. Sato, became 80 years old, 23rd of February, 2012. And Setsuko and I had planned a big birthday celebration for them and the family to be held in a hotel in New York City, the Kitano Hotel, in the basement of which there's a very elegant, old-fashioned Japanese restaurant, the type of restaurant that elderly Japanese people would like. So we'd arranged that, and we'd taken a room, a room on upstairs where people could leave their coats and where afterwards we could have the birthday cake and the champagne and so forth. So we first of all, drove down to the city to see Mr. and Mrs. Sato and had tea with them in their flat in New York. And I mentioned to Mr. Sato that I had organized this book according to the five classical elements. And because she's Japanese and was familiar with it, she was very excited by this and went into the bedroom and wrote on a piece of paper the five elements in English and then with their Chinese characters and then with how you say each of the five in Japanese. And gave it to me in a little ceremonial way Japanese people do, and that was all lovely. And then we walked over to the hotel, checked in, saw the room, and then Mr. and Mrs. Sato came for the party, which was an enormous success. And after the dinner was over, the 12 or so of us in the family went upstairs to the room where the cake was ready. We lit and blew out the candles. And then we had a couple of bottles of Dom Perignon, which we opened, and everyone toasted each other. And then there were some children who had made a videotape of the highlights of Mrs. Sartre's life thus far. And this we watched, and everyone enjoyed it. And then she, her English was not frightfully good, had been preparing all day a speech by walking around Central Park with a friend of hers and reciting it. And she recited it in the party, got it absolutely right, went and hugged everybody at the party, sat down on a sofa, and instantly became unconscious and never recovered and died. And although we were all shocked, it couldn't in a way have been a better passing.
Simon, there's obviously sadness in that story, but I'll tell you what, that's the way I want to go.
Don't we all? I mean, my word. But the wonderful thing from my point of view is she left me this legacy. The last thing she ever wrote in her life was that card with the five elements. And so,
and you've reproduced that in your book.
Exactly. The publisher is very good about that and reproduced it. So poignant, but perfect in its own way.
That is an absolutely wonderful story, and again, just gives greater insight into in how you did this. But now let's get down to some of the details. I think we've got the big picture now. You've got this organization of your book. Which of these stories fascinated you the most? They're all fascinating in their own ways, but which one did you find the most interesting?
Well, gosh, I suppose I could select one or two from each of the five categories. The Lewis and Clark, I think, I was pretty familiar with. And so perhaps to say it was less fascinating would be doing it a great disservice. It was just that it was a relatively familiar story. But moving on to the second...
Before you leave Lewis and Clark, in that section, you did point... The book is just full of these fascinating facts that strike me, first of all, as being extraordinary and then actually very commonsensical. That first section is about surveying the country. And when you think about a survey, of course, the survey must start somewhere. Mm-hmm. I did not realize that there was literally a place in Ohio that you have a photograph of called the Point of Beginning.
Yes.
I was telling my IT fellow about that this morning, Brian Presley here at the law school. And he looked at me and he said, boy, that makes sense. Where is that? So, tell us about it, please.
Well, this goes a little earlier than Lewis and Clark. It was actually 1785 when Jefferson obviously wasn't president then, but managed to get through the Congress at the time what was called the Land Ordinance of 1785, which decreed that unlike in Britain, where the land was generally held by the aristocracy, the royal family, or the church, that Americans could own land. Because once you own land, for one thing, the government can raise money on it by taxing you. So it's a good means of the government raising revenue from land which would otherwise sit uselessly. Because, of course, if you owned it, it wouldn't be useless. You would farm it or you'd put a house on it or whatever. So he decided very wisely, in my view, that's one of the great, many great things about Jefferson, but one of the more forgotten great things. He said, well, if we were going to sell the land or allow people to buy it, and by this we mean the land west of the original 13 colonies, so west of the Ohio River, essentially, we need to survey it. And so he appointed a geographer of the United States was appointed, a man called Thomas Hutchins, who was a surveyor, and said, well, if we're going to lay out a plot to show, you know, where the land is and how we can parcel it out to sell it, we need to develop a system. And so the whole system of ranges and sections that we know today, farmers talk about a half section or a quarter section if they farm in Iowa or Nebraska or wherever, that was all established. And they had to decide, well, where are we going to begin it all? Where are the great horizontal line that's going to go all the way off to the Pacific and the north-south line that'll go all the way up to the North Pole? And they decided it would be in a place called East Liverpool, Ohio, which is the actual point is in the middle of the river, I think, the Ohio River, at the point where Pennsylvania, Ohio, and a little tongue of West Virginia meet. And onshore, they built an obelisk, which still remains today. It is known as the Point of Beginning. And from that, particularly the east-west line, an imaginary line, of course, goes out all the way to the ocean. And whenever you fly over the country and see a patchwork of those little squares, look little from an aeroplane, of course, those squares all are based on and north-south lines which originate in East Liverpool. So you're right to have
Simon,
asked
that is
me
absolutely
that.
Extraordinary.
It is, isn't it? I mean, it's nothing to do with Lewis and Clark, but it's
sure.
Hugely symbolically important.
But it was in that part of your book, which is why I mentioned it, but I didn't want to leave that behind. Whenever you fly across the country, you do. You see that patchwork, and I recall that there, I have a personal connection. I grew up in a place that was simply called Avon Township.
Right.
That's where that idea came from. I had no idea until you pointed it out, and I further had no idea about this Point of Beginning, and I guess most Americans don't because it's pretty much neglected, isn't it?
Terribly neglected. I mean, poor old East Liverpool, it was the town that used to be the center of the American crockery industry. Nearly every plate, cup, and saucer you ever used was made in East Liverpool. Now there are only two or three crockery-making factories there now. The place is very sad and broken down. And if you drive eastbound from East Liverpool to the river to cross it to go to Pennsylvania and to New York, you then pass. There's a sort of forlorn, rubbish-filled little parking lot. Beyond it is a factory which makes the chemicals for hydrofracking, so very, very busy place at the moment. And there is this obelisk and a few historical society notices telling you what it is. But most people just hurry on by. But if you stop, it is one of the most symbolically important places in the United States.
Well, that's not very far from where I'm sitting here in the Appalachian Mountains. And so one of these days, I'm going to make a trip to East Liverpool, Ohio. And I'm betting that other people will do that too now.
But I think also you should go southwards from where you are and go to another place, which I found equally fascinating, and that relates to the second chapter of the book, the Earth chapter, and that is this little town called New Harmony, Indiana, which is at the junction of the Ohio River and the Wabash River. And basically what it was it was set up by a group of German religious zealots who came over having been denied permission to practice their particular religion in Germany. They came to the United States, set up a colony, first of all, a place called Harmony in Pennsylvania. They got on so well, they expanded more than they expected, and they looked for more land and came to this junction between these two rivers, and they settled in New Harmony. Then they got even bigger and had to go somewhere else, back to Pennsylvania, to an even bigger place called Economy. Well, when their settlement of little houses, some of which still exist, was put up for sale, it was bought by a British utopian called Robert Owen, who had set up a mill workers' town near Edinburgh, which was a model community for the workers in the cotton mills on the Clyde. Rather, this was near Glasgow, not Edinburgh. And he, so pleased was he with the success of this, he thought, well, let's try it in the New World. And this was at a time when a number of other utopian communities were being built. So he settled there, brought some like-minded people, bought the land from the Germans and built some more houses, and then decided, and this was the important decision, that it should be a center for the dissemination of knowledge to working people who might otherwise be denied access to good education.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Simon Winchester about his marvelous new book, The Men Who United the States. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and hear some more from Simon Winchester. Don't touch that dial. So Doug Smith, the quiz guy, is with us once again. Doug, do you have a hard question for our contestant today?
How you doing, sir? We have a great question today.
A great question.
And we think it's a great question, absolutely.
All right. What is this great question?
Which constitutional amendment resulted in the enfranchisement of the greatest number of voters?
Which constitutional amendment, right? Not the original Constitution.
That's
resulted
right.
in the enfranchisement of the greatest number of voters?
Which one meant we had more people voting than ever?
Okay, and in fact, it was this action that made the greatest number at one time be able to vote.
That's right.
Got it.
Is it A, the 15th Amendment? B, the 19th Amendment.
Well, you know, that's four greater than the 15th. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it is more powerful. Okay, go on.
Or C, the 23rd Amendment.
Even more powerful, the 23rd. So the 15th or the 19th or the 23rd Amendments, A, B, and C, which of those three gave the vote to the greatest number of voters? Let's see what our contestant has to say about that.
What is your name, sir?
My name is Christopher.
Christopher, where are you from?
Brockbridge County, Virginia.
Brockbridge County, Virginia. Well, that's a tough question. Do you have any idea what the answer might be?
I would rule out the first one, A. I believe it's either the 14th or excuse me, I believe it's either the 14th or the 19th. I can't remember which letter was which. But
Well, let me just restate it for you then. A is the 15th Amendment. You don't think it's the 15th?
No, sir.
Well, what did the 15th do?
I'm not sure what the 15th does.
Well, wait a second, then. If you don't know what the 15th was, how do you know it's not the 15th?
Well, I don't. I just know that the 14th and the 19th increased significantly the number of people that were able to vote.
I see.
Assuming there probably weren't three of them that did that.
I see. So you're just sort of by default, you're thinking you like the 19th better. What did the 19th do?
The 19th... I believe changed the original article that stated that all other persons, I believe, other than white males, were 3/5 of a person. I could be slightly off there, but I want to say the 19th changed the fact that African Americans were no longer 3/5 of a person for legislative or for voting purposes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're angling toward, or you're thinking it's choice B, the 19th. And what about choice C, the 23rd?
The 23rd, I believe, said that no one could be denied the right to vote based on age, sex, race, things of that nature.
Okay, well, is that your final answer then? B, the 19th Amendment?
I'm leaning towards C, actually, because I want to say that since that amendment came later, the country was probably more populous, and it applied to all races as opposed to the 19th only applying to a certain class of races. So based on that, I'm going to assume it was the 23rd and go with C.
The 23rd C. Well, let's see how you did.
Okay, quiz guy, what's the correct answer?
The correct answer, of course, is the 19th Amendment.
Oh, geez, Louise. I was thinking the 23rd had to be the most powerful. Why was it? What did the 19th Amendment do? What was that?
Well, of course, that granted women the right to suffrage.
Ah, yes, it did. And there are lots of women out there.
That's right, 1920. So even in the early 20th century, women made up a large portion of our population. That may not have been the case. Right. In the early parts of the Republic, it was probably more dominated by males at the time.
That's right, because when the first French trappers came over and the first British explorers, it was overwhelmingly male.
That's right.
But the general distribution, if I understand correctly, I'm no demographer, but my understanding is about 51% of the population of the world and of most countries is women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep, and moreover, even... You don't even have to say that. We're just talking about the greatest number of people. But what about that 15th Amendment?
Well, you know, the 15th Amendment is really interesting because it gave African Americans the right to vote if they were male.
Ah, so it was a subset of a subset.
Exactly.
Right. We forget that African American men got the vote, technically, at least constitutionally. We know that effectively it was a lot longer, but constitutionally they got it decades before women.
1870, African American men got the right to vote Women would have to wait another 50 years before they would get a chance to punch that Chad.
Do you know? That's an obscure reference going back. You remember what Chads are, don't you? Sure you do. You know, my wife is the one who reminds me of that periodically. Mm. She will say, you know, we were the last ones in line. And, well, she's right. She's still irritated about that.
That's one of the great things about the Constitution, of course, is through the amendment process, we've added more and we've enfranchised more and more people.
Yep.
And so now we have great voices and representation among all people.
You know, that's one thing, one way to look at our constitutional history is that we started out with all of these highfalutin beliefs, and they're good ones, you know, all men are created equal, but think about that. Even then, we were excluding more than half the population. And you can think of our constitutional history as just being more and more and more conclusive.
That's right. Now, let's not leave out the 23rd Amendment.
What was the 23rd Amendment?
This allows people in Washington, D.C. the right to vote. 1961.
I bet that's very important. And then let's just talk about that briefly. So why would the District of Columbia people not have the right to vote to begin with?
Well, even today, they have no representation in Congress.
Right.
And so maybe you've seen the license plate. No taxation without representation.
From D.C., yeah.
From Washington, D.C.
Well, it's interesting, and I guess the reason for this is because when we formed our country, there was no Washington, D.C. There was an anticipation that you'd have a 100-square-mile federal district, but it wasn't actually established for years after. And all the voting was done on the basis of states.
That's correct.
And all Congress was divided and represented on the basis of states, and so states have representatives and states have senators. And I think maybe it was just an afterthought. Someone said, what about people who live in the district? And to this day, as you said, they don't have representatives. They don't have senators. They have like a non-voting representative who observes in Congress. But the 23rd Amendment allowed them to vote in presidential elections.
That's right. And so if you're a member of the district, if you're a resident of the District of Columbia, be proud. As few times as we've ever amended our U.S. Constitution, you got one of the 27.
Just for you.
Just for you, Washington.
Maybe we'll have to do a 28th and let you actually have a representative in Congress one of these days. There'd be a concept.
I'm sorry. That was a tough question, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. I clearly need to brush up on my on my amendments here.
We all need to brush up on them. I'll tell you a secret. I occasionally get mixed up. In fact, recently I was talking about prohibition, and I couldn't remember which one started prohibition and which one stopped prohibition. And it's a very confusing thing, but at least you knew what many of the amendments did. You just had to match up the amendment with the number. But better luck next time.
Well, it's an important topic with the Supreme Court recently overruling the Voting Rights Act, so I think it's an important thing for us to go back in time and see how hard people fought to give these people the right to vote like they deserved, and maybe time to, you know, push that into the current context of maybe, at least in my opinion, pumping the brakes before we start doing things that might take away those rights from people that we fought so hard to gain for them. But with that, I really thank you guys for letting me participate and for bringing these sort of past as well as current really important topics to the public's attention.
Well said, sir. Well said indeed. And you do get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. In fact, you get the new version with a beautiful photograph of Montpelier on the cover. So look forward to that.
Excellent. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Simon Winchester about his remarkable new book, The Men Who United the States. It's a book arranged around several different themes like wood and metal and water, all of the various elements that explorers and developers of our nation encountered as they literally knit the nation together by constructing these new physical structures. One such fellow was a British guy by the name of Robert Owen. He was one of many utopians who came to the United States and wanted to found new societies. And just before the break, Simon was telling us about Robert Owen's creation at a place called New Harmony, Indiana.
So I want, he said, intellectuals to come here to believe in what I'm doing and to set up schools. And so he went to Philadelphia, which was then the sort of intellectual capital of America, and looked for knowledgeable, wise people who might be interested in joining his experiment. And one of them was this Scotsman called William McClure, who at the time was president of the American Philosophical Society, which had been set up by Benjamin Franklin. McClure was wealthy. He and his father had made money of export-import business. He had decided as a man of leisure that he would pursue geology as a sort of intellectual pursuit. Largely, he said, most geologists are very insulted when I tell them this, because it was the easiest of sciences to learn. And he then did what turns out to be the first ever geological map of anywhere, which was of the United States, the Eastern Mountains, in 1809, and wrote a number of papers about geology. And when Robert Owen said, would you like to come and move from Philadelphia and come and live in this funny little town in New Harmony, he actually thought, you know, it's not a bad idea. And so he gathered a group of about 40 like-minded people who, and it's an extraordinary thing to do, really, to leave the relative comforts of a metropolitan community like Philadelphia and go off into the unknown with this sort of slightly wild-eyed Scottish Robert Owen. But they did. They got on a boat in Pittsburgh, which was called the Philanthropist, but they renamed it because everyone on it was so clever, the Boatload of Knowledge. And they took off down this ice-choked river in 1825. And it took about 6 weeks, I think, for them to get to the junction with the Wabash. And Robert Owen himself had been much more sensible and gone down by stagecoach. And they spilled off the boat and into the houses, which had Owen and the Germans previously had built for him, and set up this community. And without making this rather long story even longer than it should be, McClure particularly trained sufficient number of geologists that the geological surveys of the states of Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, and Ohio were all done by men who graduated from the schools in New Harmony, Indiana. So
that is remarkable,
isn't it? And yet we've forgotten it. Most people, I don't know about you, Stuart, but most people, unless they've actually been there to see the funny little buildings, but nowadays, to recognize its importance, the visitor center was designed by Richard Meyer. There's a church there was designed by Philip Johnson. So a number of famous American architects have come there to sort of add their praise to the place. But it is otherwise generally forgotten and yet hugely important, just like East Liverpool, hugely important in the story of the building of this country.
That's just utterly fascinating, and I won't even claim to have forgotten it. I'll simply claim complete ignorance of it. I don't think I'd ever heard of it.
Well, then you ask, well, there's one chap I must mention from that geological chapter who absolutely astonished me, and that is one of the four great survey leaders. President Lincoln set up in the 1860s, when he was mostly occupied with other things, of course, the idea that the country should be formally and properly geologically surveyed. And so he appointed, they were called the four great surveys. One of them, the most complicated.
Wait just a minute, Simon. In the midst of our greatest constitutional crisis, with Washington, D.C. constantly in danger of being encircled by Confederate troops, Lincoln spared a thought for geological surveys?
Isn't it astonishing? That's another thing that we generally forget, that other aspects of government and administration of this country had to go on despite the obvious distractions posed by the Civil War. Yes.
It might have been a nice respite for him. Bring the geologists in. Get the generals out of here. Bring the geologists in.
Much more agreeable people. You never see a fat geologist, for instance. Generals and policemen, otherwise. So one of the most complicated survey was called the Great Survey of the 40th Parallel, which took 7 years to accomplish. And it essentially surveyed in great detail a strip of land about 200 miles wide from Sacramento in the west to Cheyenne in the east. And the man that was charged with leading this survey was a fellow called Clarence King. Now, Clarence King came from a very good patrician WASP family in Newport, Rhode Island. And he went to Yale, I think, and I think he got a PhD at Harvard. It may have been the other way around. Anyway, he was very bright, diminutive, talkative, amusing and a heroic figure. And he did brilliantly with this survey. And when it was over, so appreciative was the American government that he was made the first ever director of a new body that was set up, which still exists today, and that's the United States Geological Survey. So Clarence King was the first director of the USGS. There is, however, one oddity, if I can call about that, about his personal life. He was very sexually energetic, but he was not in the slightest bit interested in white women. He was only interested in Native American women or black women. Well, he didn't marry until well on in years and living in New York, when he was walking through Riverside Park one day and he saw a woman, a black woman, who he thought was the woman of his dreams. And he went up to her, and instead of saying, "Hello, I'm Clarence King, I'm the director of the US Geological Survey, would you like to have dinner with me?" thinking very quickly on his feet, but perhaps a little too quickly for his own good, he said, "Madam, my name is James Todd, and although I look white, I'm actually black, and I'm a porter on the Pullman Railway Company. Will you have dinner with me?" And to cut a very long story short, this woman, who was called Ada Copeland and came from Georgia, from a slave family, said she would. They fell in love, they married, they had five children. And from that moment on, for the rest of his life, he lived a double life.
No way. I was about to ask, at what point did he reveal himself to his wife? And he didn't?
He didn't. Not until on his deathbed. And even then, he didn't reveal himself totally. He would go off to the US Geological Survey offices and say, "Well, that was quite a field trip I've been on." Would stay there for 2 or 3 weeks. Having told his wife, who lived in Queens with him, Mrs. Todd, that he was going off to work as a porter on the California Zephyr or the 20th Century Limited or whatever, and would stay there for, be away for 3 weeks. And then after 3 weeks, he would leave the Geological Survey, walk across the newly built Brooklyn Bridge, go home to his wife in Queens and say, "Well, that was quite a trip. I picked up $30 in tips." And so it went on. And she might have had a clue insofar as two of her children were white as the driven snow, that something was a little odd about him, but she never twigged. Finally, I mean, the stresses of this on him were horrendous. Two households, well, one household, he lived as a bachelor in a hotel in Lower Manhattan.
So he didn't have another honey someplace else.
He didn't have another honey, no. And finally, he got TB and went off to convalesce in Albuquerque and died. And as he was on his deathbed, he confessed to the doctor that Mrs. Todd was, in fact, Mrs. King, and should be told that for legal reasons, because of will and so forth. And very kindly, when he did die, the doctor, having heard his story and being generally sympathetic, when he had to fill out the death certificate, he struck out what race the man was, didn't enter either white or black, but simply wrote in by hand his race was American, which I thought was very much played into what I'm trying to write about in this book.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where I'm speaking with author Simon Winchester about his new book, The Men Who United the States. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish up our conversation with Simon Winchester. Stay with us.
To unify and govern themselves, America's 13 former colonies adopted the Articles of Confederation in 1781. Problems soon arose with this loose alliance of states. When individual states refused to pay their share of taxes, the central government had no way to force payment. States violated treaties that the central government made with other countries and negotiated their own treaties with Native American nations and with other states. Such breaches raised fears that the Union would dissolve and increased worry that Great Britain or another country could seize and rule individual states and territories. States also violated each other's rights by restricting trade and taxing imported interstate goods. The erection of such trade barriers and their negative impact on the U.S. economy were among the primary evils to be addressed both at the Annapolis Convention of 1786 and at the more famous Constitutional Convention of 1787. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish up our conversation with Simon Winchester, author of The Men Who United the States. Of all the other wonderful stories you have, Simon, pick another one and share it with us, perhaps from another section in the book.
What I'd like to do is to play you a little bit of music. One little story that I think is absolutely charming and relates to the politics of the moment is the distribution of electricity to this country, most notably FDR's plan, the Rural Electrification Administration, which would bring electricity to America's farms. In the 1930s, there were 800,000 farms in this country that did not have electricity. And the stories of how they got electricity, I mean, basically what happened is if you lived in the middle of Iowa, you didn't have a farm, you had a farm but no electricity, the men from the REA would come and say, for $5, join a co-op and we will give you electricity. We'll sell you electricity. But it'll cost you $5 and that'll bring the line to your house. And most farms, $5 to a farmer in the 1930s was a great deal of money. The REA men were told always to talk to the farmers' wives, particularly, because they were the ones that so much of the work, heating the water and filling the oil lamps and milking the cows, if they only had electricity, it would be so much easier. They persuaded their husbands in the end to part with the $5. And then you would see the trucks in the distance putting up the poles and the wires coming closer and closer and closer to your house. And then finally, the day would come when the REA men would come into your farmhouse and put in the plugs and put in the circuit for the range and the 15-amp circuits for the lights and so forth. And it was usually at about 6 p.m. And often the stories I've read, it was in November when the lights had gone out. It was cold. People were lighting oil lamps as usual. But on this occasion, you were told, be ready to switch on electricity. And there's one lovely story of an old farmer who got up on the table in the living room and pulled the chain beside the bulb which had been put up over the living room, dining room table, and pulled it, and first weakly and then gloriously the light came on. And he was astonished by this and delighted. And he called to his son in the next room and said, son, hold this chain, will you? And I'll come and switch the light on in the bedroom. And his son said, Dad, you don't have to hold the chain. The electricity is going to stay on no matter what. Well, all the, and it is instructive, I think, to remember the first place in America to receive distributed electricity, rural electricity, was the 8th Congressional District of Ohio, near Miami, Ohio. The first beneficiary of big government when it comes to electricity. Well, who is the congressional representative today for the 8th District of Ohio? John Boehner.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. I love the idea that this implacable foe of big government, his district was the most important beneficiary, the first beneficiary of big government 80 years ago.
That is a compelling story as well.
Samuel Morse, the telegraph, hugely important. Marconi, 1902, invented wireless. He heard Morse code symbols being sent out from Cornwall, sitting up in his underneath an aerial in Newfoundland. He first heard the transmission that his people in Cornwall were tapping out on them, and he realized that radio was an invention that was going to work. So all of a sudden, everyone had radio sets, but only to transmit Morse. Then this long-forgotten man called Reginald Fessenden came onto the scene, working for the Weather Bureau in Washington, but looking after weather forecasting on the East Coast, worked out in his spare time how to transmit not just Morse, but voice by radio. And the first time he did this, he built a big aerial, a place called Brant Rock, Massachusetts, and sent out by Morse code a signal to all the ships in the Western Atlantic of the United Fruit Company that were bringing bananas, sounds ludicrous, from the Central American ports up to Baltimore and New York and Savannah and so forth. Listen out at 1 minute to midnight on Christmas Eve, 1906, for a transmission. Happened to be a dark and stormy night. Fantastic blizzard. The ships were rolling heavily. The radio operators went to their radio cabins, tuned in, listened to the static, listened to the Morse code from other ships nearby them. But then they heard a signal coming from Massachusetts. Well, they didn't know it was Massachusetts, but they heard the signal. And they heard, instead of Morse code, for the first time ever, they heard this. And with that, the playing of Handel's Xerxes, after that, Fessenden himself came on and wished everyone a happy Christmas and recited the Lord's Prayer. Radio began, and the national conversation, a great unifying electronic entity, formally got underway.
What an inspiring story, and what a transformational moment. And of course, we on this show are very grateful for all the pioneers of radio.
Exactly, and television too, but to me, radio and that image of the family gathered around the radio set, all listening to one show broadcasted from, I don't know, whether it was Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra in New York or whether it was a comedy show being broadcast from Los Angeles, that truly knit the country together. The sad thing now is with the internet, the family doesn't exist, you know, because Tommy is up in his room surfing the web. The girl is texting her chums. Mother is watching such and such a program. Father's watching Netflix. So radio, I think, had a tremendously unifying importance to this country, which cannot be said today with cable television, with everything being segmented into sort of small interest groups. Radio was important, and it all began.
Right, and not just on a micro level, but on a macro level as well, because when there were relatively few radio broadcasts, relatively few radio networks, people did all tend to listen to more or less the same things, and that would be the basis for the water cooler discussions the next day.
Then exactly. Maybe, of course, terrified if they had listened to Orson Welles suggesting that men from Mars had invaded New Jersey.
Well, I think we should make a new rule, Simon, that people must listen only to public radio and primarily, of course, this show. And then we'll all have something to talk about in common, right?
Yes.
Well, Simon Winchester, thank you so very much. Now, before we go, the title of your book, again, is The Men Who United the States. Is that now available in bookstores?
It is available from the 15th of October. And in England about a month later. But yes, effectively, it's available now.
And they, of course, can get it on Amazon.com.
I wish they wouldn't, but you know what I mean. I'm glad if they do, but I want to keep it bookstores going too.
Yes, I agree with you. So go to your local bookstore and ask for Simon Winchester's wonderful new book, The Men Who United the States. Simon Winchester, thank you so much for your time.
Stuart, thank you very much too.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and wasn't that a marvelous interview with Simon Winchester? It's rare that you get somebody who's such a good storyteller and can maintain your interest over, well, over two whole episodes, basically, of our show. We have just a few minutes left in this episode, and I'm really pleased about that because I found out, much to my chagrin, that when we did our recent annual roundup of Supreme Court cases, I had neglected to put in one of the interviews, one of my colleagues, Dean Charlie Condon of the Appalachian School of Law, had made the effort to come all the way down to WETS and give us a great summation of a very interesting case now pending before the court. And somehow I misplaced that file when I put together the roundup episode. But here, without further ado, is Charlie Condon of the Appalachian School of Law, and he's going to tell us about a fascinating case pending in front of the U.S. Supreme Court.
We're talking about a case involving the Fair Labor Standards Act.
A huge accomplishment of the New Deal. It was one of those statutes enacted during the 1930s originally, I believe, wasn't it?
Correct.
On the basis of the power of Congress to regulate commerce, I believe. So that's the constitutional angle, but you're going to talk more about a statutory issue then, aren't you?
Correct. There'll be a specific section, Section 208 of the Fair Labor Standards Act, mm-hmm. that will be interpreted by the United States Supreme Court.
Okay. So what's the issue?
The issue is, what does it mean when you change clothes, and what are clothes under the Fair Labor Standards Act?
What does clothing have to do with fair labor standards, Charlie?
This case arose from the United States Steel Corporation, Gary, Indiana plant. And the workers routinely work around hazardous materials, hot molten steel, and other hazards, so they need protective clothing and other protective gear. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act and the way it has been interpreted over the years, the union and the management can essentially negotiate in terms of when the clock starts running on paying people to work for United States Steel.
Oh, so the issue is whether you get paid for putting on your work clothes or not.
Exactly.
When taking them off. Oh, okay.
And for years, people have been able to negotiate that. In fact, the steelworkers did negotiate a contract with United States Steel that covered changing clothes. Mm-hmm. The difference now is that some employees of United States Steel decided that changing clothes was just clothes. It wasn't adding all of this safety gear, and in fact, that took a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. And so they're concerned about the fact that they're spending more time putting the gear on and at the end of the shift taking the gear off, none of which time they're being paid for.
Oh, okay. So that's what they're concerned about. They want to get paid for, I mean, what kind of gear are we talking about?
There's a variety of protective gear. They have flame retardant jackets that they wear. They're, of course, goggles and face shields. Something interesting in the opinion called a snood.
A snood.
Which is a face shield that has a garment over it that's kind of a shroud that fits over the shoulders and the chest area of the worker.
Well, I think I've seen those. It's like you put it over your entire head.
Correct.
And then it's in a, yeah, okay, I've seen those before.
And they also are talking about other routine safety gear such as hard hats, safety goggles, earplugs, safety boots, the steel-toed boots, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So they're concerned that it takes a little bit longer than just changing a shirt or a pair of trousers.
I see. Okay, so the issue here then is, well, from the worker's perspective, if these things are clothes, they're not going to get any more compensation for the time it takes to put on
correct.
This stuff or take it off. But if this stuff is not clothing, then they do get more compensation.
That's correct.
And okay.
The Supreme Court comes down and says, here's a list of what clothes consist of, and here is a list of what are not clothes, then that will be a definitive decision, and everyone will be able to take away from the decision how to compensate people.
How is the Supreme Court deciding? Is there any precedent here? I mean, if I'm a Supreme Court justice, how do I figure out whether this stuff is clothing or not?
Well, there are cases, and in fact, this particular case came from the Seventh Circuit, mm-hmm. and the Seventh Circuit said it's clear that these items are clothes. And so the argument then is Seventh Circuit is wrong, and in fact, there should be a distinction made between clothes and safety equipment or safety gear that, in fact, the plaintiffs are arguing in this case. There's a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion that sort of supports their position, and of course, they're relying on it strongly and arguing strongly that these specific items that are different from clothes should be treated differently. Mm-hmm. However, the Seventh Circuit rejected their argument and said, clothes are clothes. One of the interesting parts about this case is that in the briefs and also in the Seventh Circuit opinion and everything associated with this case, are definitions from dictionaries. Mm-hmm. There are several different versions of dictionaries that are cited on both sides of the argument that, oh, these definitions are the best for what clothes are. And the other side, well, no, here's definitions that are better for defining what clothes are. So the U.S. Supreme Court is essentially going to determine once and for all, what are clothes, what are changing clothes, and what should be included.
If I were sitting on the Supreme Court, I could see both sides of this. If I'm a worker, clearly, you know, if I have to put on special clothing, I mean, that's part of my job. And if it takes me 10 minutes at the beginning of each day to put it on and 10 minutes to take it off at the end of the day, and I've got no choice, and I certainly see that as part of my workday. On the other hand, there are lots and lots of people who have to put on special clothes to go to work every day. If you're a lawyer, for example, which I happen to know a little bit about, you typically have to put a suit on. Certainly if you're going to court, you do. And that takes time, and you don't get compensated for putting on your suit at home and tying that tie around your neck as much as you might like to be. So I guess I can see that there are arguments to be made on both sides of this issue.
There are, and several arguments being made by the opponents of this, the mm-hmm. industry side. They're suggesting that if the court were to find that putting these clothes on is when the clock starts, that's only part of the issue. The other part of the issue is, in a lot of cases, these people, particularly like in a steel mill where they have dangerous conditions for a significant portion of the steel mill, these people will dress in the locker room and then they'll walk to their workstation or ride a golf cart or something to their workstation. Not only then would you have to compensate them for the time that they put on the clothes, but also the travel time to actually getting to the workstation, to the machine they operate or something
like
that.
Yeah, and I can see that's a significant amount of time. But if you add that in, I think that actually strengthens the worker's position, doesn't it? If you have to go to work to find the clothes, and then you have to be transported from one part of the work site to another part of the work site, that's kind of like a coal miner saying, I should be compensated for the time it takes me to get down to the mine.
I think you're right.
To go down the shaft. I think that actually strengthens the worker's case.
I think it does, but mm-hmm. considering the fact that the industry's side of it is looking at what it's going to cost them to compensate the worker, they are correct, I think, in pointing out that's one of the implications of the decision.
Yeah, a lot of money involved here. I think maybe a lot of these industries are going to have to move their locker rooms closer to the work sites if the case doesn't go their way. Any predictions?
I think there's going to be a lot of opinion written on this. I think, of course, there will be a majority opinion, but I think there will be concurrences, and I'm sure that we can count on a couple of good, lively dissents in this case.
Where do you think the majority is going to come down? Come on, Charlie, you can make a prediction now.
I think they're going to draw a line, but it's not going to be a bright line. Mm-hmm. I think they will exclude certain parts of the gear and count them as clothing, and other parts they probably will say, example, hard hats, earplugs, safety shoes, are going to be considered just minimal time spent, so those should not count as the start of the workday.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Simon Winchester for telling us all about his new book, The Men Who United the States. That's available in bookstores now and on Amazon, so go out and get a copy. Thanks to Charlie Condon, too, for telling us about that fascinating labor case before the Supreme Court. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And hey, the guys who play our theme song, they're the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Thanks, fellas. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.